The Guardian.
Hello and welcome to the Guardian Football Weekly. The Premier League, City go top as the wind and Everton halt Liverpool at Goodison. Penalties at Wembley, Spurs score theirs, but should it have been given? Arsenal miss theirs, but should it have been given? And should they all go back and retake it anyway? Brendan Rodgers and Scott Parker both lose their first games in charge. In the Championship, Jack Grealish scores a cracker. Barcelona are finally in front of Real Madrid in El Clasico victories. We'll round up all of Europe, we'll take your questions and read a lovely tweet from Baldock Town FC. All on today's Guardian Football Weekly. On the panel today, Barry Glendenning. How are you?
I'm very well, thank you.
You look nice.
Good. We aim to please.
Lars Sivertsen, how are you?
Hi, Max. I'm good.
I feel now if I don't say you also look nice that you'll be insulted.
I'm not sure I do, though, to be fair.
I think you look great.
I thought when Barry came in, I thought he'd lost weight.
Oh, you've been to the gym, haven't you, Barry?
Sprightly. I have returned to the gym, yes.
Have you lost any weight?
I don't know.
Oh. Well, that's interesting. John Bruin, how are you?
I'm all right, Max. How are you?
Nice to see you.
Nice to see you.
You also look nice.
Thanks.
That's okay.
You really mean it.
I'm more an arm round the shoulder manager than a kick. You know, I just want everyone to feel 10 feet tall.
It is true. Actually, on my first pod, you just told me to effing run about a bit.
Yeah.
It was really awkward.
Exactly, yeah. You know, kiss the badge.
Yeah.
And then the fans will love you. Let's start at Goodison Park on a windy day in Liverpool. Everton 0, Liverpool 0. I mean, it was a breathless game, John, wasn't it?
Yeah, I mean, I think in terms of quality, there wasn't a great deal of it, but tension was what made this hugely watchable. And also, you've got that... I mean, Goodison Park is, at times, can be a barren wasteland in terms of atmosphere. But that game... Let's put it this way. I think Everton fans, and a lot of them would admit this, no one moans like Evertonians. And they're moaning about their own team, and they're moaning about Liverpool. And it just added to this sort of cauldron of, I would say, a sort of distaste for what was going on there. And at the same time, Liverpool, despite the protestations of their manager after the game, are having problems in the title race. You have to say it's a local derby. They're always difficult fixtures. There's been quite a few nil-nils in this fixture recently. I said last time I was on that Jurgen Klopp had reduced Manchester United Liverpool to a dull fixture. Well, he seems to have done the same. So I'm not joking, of course. But and I suppose if we talk about it, we took Mohamed Salah's loss of confidence is the, I suppose, the key takeaway from that game.
Is the key takeaway not it was windy, Barry?
Well, there do seem to be signs that Jurgen Klopp is, if not buckling, wilting under the pressure of trying to lead Liverpool to the first title in 29 years. After he was finished having an argument with a small child, one of the ball boys, he then blamed the weather, which I'm guessing Everton also had to deal with. It didn't stop being windy every time they were, you know, trying to do something. And he had a quite narky go at a journalist who I thought asked him quite a legitimate question about playing too defensively when he went on a, I wouldn't say a rant, but, you know, he clearly was, you know, he basically told the journalist in question, I don't know who it was, that it was a stupid question he was asking. I'm very disappointed with that question, and suggesting the journalist knew nothing. But I thought they were a bit too defensive for quite a long spell, and played with two central midfielders. I didn't think thought they didn't need two.
Lars, in defence of Jurgen Klopp or not?
I think we are... Okay, so we tend to do this with these big games. So if Liverpool had gotten a goal from somewhere, like a shot bouncing in off of Kurt Zouma's kidney or something, then we would talk about how they held their nerve, you know, and they showed such composure. But in the end, none of the shots did go in, and now we're talking about them bottling it. So you can accuse us in the media for spinning narratives and inventing things. But I did think, watching this, that there's something that doesn't look right about Liverpool now. It's the way they're missing chances. It's the way that decisions are being made in a slightly rushed manner when they're attacking. It's not flowing. It's not fluid. So you do wonder if the pressure is an element here. But certainly this midfield of having both Fabinho and Henderson in there, I'm not a huge fan of. I think it ends up being a little bit sideways, the passing. I think you wonder why Keita is suddenly completely sidelined now, because I felt like he was actually starting to find his feet at Liverpool. And then he's been out, and I think they do suffer in terms of creating things from midfield.
And Shaqiri as well made such a difference. You know, at the start of the season, we said it a thousand times, what a bargain Shaqiri is. He's brilliant off the bench. He started a few games. I did wonder why he wasn't coming on in this game.
Well, you could wonder why he wasn't starting instead of Origi, who, okay, he scored against Watford, but he's not the top level. I wouldn't say he's as high a standard as Shaqiri is. And maybe if you play Shaqiri, it adds a bit of ballast into the midfield as well. I don't think Klopp is going to take criticism of his selections. That was clear from yesterday. The problem is with the midfield is that front three were so good last season. They were so good for half of this season. Is the midfield doesn't supply any goals. Now, any of the good teams over the years have had a midfield goal scorer, and you know, you go back to Frank Lampard, Steven Gerrard for Liverpool, of course, and they just don't have that. And while the defence is working superbly, Van Dijk had another imperious game, the bits ahead of them are not quite functioning as they should do. And Jordan Henderson is the club captain, but he's a slightly controversial figure. And yesterday there was this strange segue towards the end of the game where he started shouting and pointing and telling everyone else what to do, but there were only 2 minutes left to play.
Yeah.
And it's like, well, maybe you should have been doing that before. And it was put to me yesterday, was that maybe he was doing it because Klopp had been shouting at him. And it does seem like a little bit of blame has been shifted around. Okay, I'm not saying Liverpool are blowing the title, but they are finding it very difficult at the moment.
I think Klopp once said something about a good press being the best playmaker in the world, and that can be true, but in these games, and we saw this at Old Trafford as well, when you face a team that's quite happy to sit back and quite happy to let you have a lot of the ball and doesn't concede a lot of space for you to run into, the need for an actual playmaker does kind of arise. And you look at that Liverpool midfield with Wijnaldum, Fabinho and Henderson, like which of these guys are going to provide like the defence-splitting pass? Like, I'm not sure where that's coming from. I think those three between them have something like two assists all season. So you do see these games when they don't have space to run into, they can't sort of win back possession high up the pitch because the opponent isn't faffing about with it too much in that area. It becomes a lot harder for them, and this is where someone like Keita, who, you know, admittedly he hasn't quite found his feet at the club yet, but he can go past people, and he can play a bit of a cutting pass now and again. And I think it is strange that he's been sidelined at this point in the season where creativity seems to be such an issue.
Barry, Liverpool had a big lead, and now they are behind Manchester City. But even still, they are, you know, they've lost one game. They've 5 clean sheets in a row. Is it too far to say if they don't win this title, they have thrown it away or they've bottled it?
I don't think it's fair to say they've bottled it, but I do think they're under pressure. Their supporters will say that we're being overly critical of them and that we have an agenda against them, which we may be being overcritical. I don't think there's any agenda, but I think the reason we're being so critical of them is because we know how good they can be, and they haven't been that good, with the exception of the game against Watford. You know, they've drawn 4 of their last 6 league games. That's not title-winning form. They'll never have a better chance to win the title. But again, there's no shame in losing the title to Manchester City, but from having been so far ahead, I wouldn't say it's a Devin lock or anything, but it is. They are capable a lot better than they're playing at the moment.
John, you have read up on the etymology, if that's the right word.
I think that is the right word.
Of the phrase bottling it, because we use it a lot. And social media is awash with people bottling things all the time, but none of us know actually why we say, have they bottled it?
Well, yeah, it's from Cockney rhyming slang.
Okay.
So I've got to slip into a different accent to be able to do this.
Okay.
So,
I'm probably the most Cockney here, which is...
Bottle and glass rhymes with...
Bottom.
Yes, mm-hmm. Arse. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Now, within the Cockney fundament, the fortitude and courage comes not from the heart as it does in other cultures, but from the...
From the backside.
From the backside, yeah.
Cockneys have brave...
Yeah. So
backs at bottoms.
Have you ever seen the documentary Club for a Quid about Leighton Orient with John Sitton's famous halftime rant? And he talks about how the players need, and if I may say this,
yes,
arsehole. Yeah, you've not got no arsehole.
Oh, literally.
And that is within the, yeah. So that's what it
people
is.
People running around the Bow Bells going, oh, the craze have got great back bottoms. Is that a thing?
Yeah, they've got. Yeah, so bravery, if you were dealing with the craze, to deal with the craze, you would have to show.
Arse.
Yes.
I mean, there's a weird sort of similar thing with Carlo Ancelotti, who wants to describe how he'd never felt pressure, said that his ass was earthquake proof.
It didn't look it.
No, indeed, but he said, my ass is earthquake proof because I have experience of this world. So, I mean, maybe he has a sort of a Cockney thing going on there.
No, the rest of his body wasn't. So it's an issue if you're on the San Andreas fault, I imagine.
But on Liverpool, before we move on, big picture, if you'd just to prove that we don't have a massive bias against them, big picture, if you'd said before the season they'll be 1 point behind City at this point in the season, I think they'd all take it. If you said two years ago that they'd be right in the title fight, you know, 1 point behind the league leaders, I think they would have taken that then as well. But it is the situation now. They've drawn, what, 5 of their last 7 in all competitions, failed to score in 3 of the last 4. I mean, that's got to be slightly worrying. That's more than just a blip and an off result. Salah scoring 1 in the last 7, and Firmino scoring 1 in the last 8. To be fair, he came off early and one of them came on late here, but still, like, the goals aren't coming and this is a bad time of the season for the goals to not come.
We should have a word on Everton. You're insinuating that the atmosphere was great. You know, Everton fans saying, why can't we do this every week? The Everton players going, why can't the Everton fans do this every week?
Well, I think I was going to talk about a couple of performances. I thought Michael Keane played very well. He made one particularly good tackle. And I always think this about Michael Keane. You know, you go back 2 years, it was between him, Alfie Mawson and Harry Maguire to step into the England team and become, you know, that World Cup legend. And he wasn't that far off it. And there was a point a couple of years ago when it wasn't working out for Keane and there were stories about how Everton regretted it and was going to sell him. Well, actually, I spoke to someone quite close to Michael Keane. He said this wasn't true. And under Marco Silva, he does look to be one of those players that has improved. But Everton, the thing is, I do look at that team and they have had an awful lot of money spent on them. And I tend to think that they should be better than they are.
Yeah, I'd agree with that. I mean, a lot of their tactics revolve around Jordan Pickford hoofing it long. And, you know, Manchester City do the same thing sometimes with Ederson, but he sort of tends to pass it, whereas Pickford is just belting it long. And when Virgil van Dijk is at the other end of the field, just heading it away time after time after time.
I think Pickford's slightly better than that as a distribution-wise.
Yeah, he is, but
it was windy.
It was windy
from all angles.
But speaking as the best footballer in the room, as a guess, and the bar is low, I'm also guessing playing football in the wind is a total nightmare. You'd rather it was hailing, sleeting, anything. The wind is the absolute worst. So I agree with Jurgen Klopp. Tottenham 1, Arsenal 1. Let's go straight to Lars. Harry Kane's penalty. The debate has been raging on social media about whether
with
Kane...
with just immeasurable tedium.
Well, I'd like you to clear it up and then we can get over it. Harry Kane was in an offside position when the free kick was taken.
But this is one of those where the people, the learned, they disagree. You know, you have Alan Shearer consulting the professional referees gang saying that it should have been a penalty. And you have like Keith Hackett saying that it was a correct penalty. And my whole thing that I keep coming back to here now, if you can have people who know the rules in and out, who know them very well, completely disagree on a fundamental call, then the rules are stupid and need to be cleared up. Like, I don't really, frankly, I don't care either way whether this was a pen or not. I really don't. I just need the rules to be clear so that, like, most people out there don't know the rules. So them disagreeing about stuff is fine. But here, even the people who know the rules very well and have, you know, their job has been to put the rules into practice, they don't seem to agree. And if that's the case, surely the rules need to be fixed somehow.
The laws.
Oh, for God's sake.
Okay, then. The game itself, Arsenal were better, weren't they, than Tottenham, Barry?
I thought so. Thought it was a game they left behind them. not just because of the late penalty miss and subsequent clearance by or block by Jan Vertonghen that prevented Aubameyang scoring the follow up. I just thought our Spurs weren't quite on it, in my opinion, and Arsenal, I think, could live to regret losing or not winning that game. Sorry, they didn't lose, of course. They just seemed better than Tottenham, and I mean the penalty that Aubameyang missed was very poor. It didn't take much saving, and there was talk then, of course, of encroachment by Vertonghen, which he did.
Not just any encroachment, as Ian Wright said on Match of the Day, extreme encroachment.
Encroachment with extreme prejudice. And while I suppose Arsenal fans, and a lot of them have been moaning about the penalty that should or shouldn't have been given when Harry Kane was or wasn't offside, I'm with Lars on this. If actual referees can't agree on it, what hope is there for the rest of us? You know, the Skodra Mustafi, again, he's constantly costing his team points, penalties, goals. They have a great capacity to shoot themselves in the foot. But it was a decent performance by them, and they should have won.
Well, with this game, Pochettino, after the game, talked about how he wouldn't brook criticism of his team's play, and I thought watching this game that Spurs look way off what they can be. Now there are reasons for that. I mean, they're tired, they've had so many injuries. Also, Harry Kane has been reintroduced to into a team that was actually doing all right without him. Mm-hmm. But then Danny Rose spoke to the journalists after the game and talked about how Pochettino's pep talk was like sending us to war. And he delivered this Churchillian halftime speech. And Spurs played okay, but they must have been pretty low down because they still didn't play superbly in that second half. It's been a bit of a grind of a season for Spurs. Of course, they're still not at their stadium. Pochettino, again, we go to this bottling thing. I don't think they're bottling it. It's just a combination of factors have added up to them losing. I mean, 2 or 3 weeks ago, I said they were completely nailed on for the top four. I'm not sure now. I just think they've been a little bit unlucky along the way.
I was actually at Wembley for this. I thought it was really noticeable how they struggled without Harry Winks in that midfield. I mean, both Sissoko and Wanyama in there. Your passing game is always going to suffer a little bit. Neither of those are, you know, slick passers of the ball. And they really seem to struggle to find the openings and get the ball moving in the way you want. I mean, when you play with wingbacks, it's all about shifting it out wide quickly and use that width. And it just wasn't happening. So you had that situation. Both Eriksen and Kane seem to have just bad days individually. Just quite simple things not coming off for them the way that you would usually. At one point you end up with Danny Rose in central midfield. I mean, with all of this sort of stuff going on, I think Spurs will be quite delighted to get out of that, which is not having lost,
especially having lost two in a row before
exactly.
That
and given that there was a big swing with Arsenal being very close to them in the table, it's really important for them to just not lose a game where a lot of things were not going for them.
And that race for the top four is actually fascinating now, isn't it? Spurs on 61, Manchester United on 58. We'll get to their game in a second. Arsenal on 57, Chelsea 56 with a game in hand. Who are you giving the top four to, Barry?
Oh, I don't know.
Well, that's exciting, isn't it?
Well, you were asking me for a prediction. It'll probably be wrong. No one's going to remember it. So I don't know.
But will anyone remember anything in, you know, years to come?
Pardon?
Will anyone remember anything?
Well, if I get... No, but sorry, people will remember it.
Okay.
But they'll only remember it if I'm wrong.
No one remembers any of your predictions. No one remembers you saying Bournemouth would get relegated. No one remembers you saying Arsenal would come second. No one remembers you saying Christian Benteke would be the leading goal scorer at the World Cup, even though he wasn't in the Belgium squad. No one remembers these things.
Yeah.
Spurs go to Dortmund tomorrow night. Is this difficult to go with a 3-0 lead? I mean, it's easier than a 2-0 lead, isn't it?
What?
Yes. I'm just saying. But how do you approach this game?
You go well. Try not to get beat by more than three goals, I guess.
Maybe I asked for that.
Yeah, no, and I think Dortmund. They've had a bit of a wobble domestically, having been in a very good position in the league. I think, I'm not saying you're ever delighted to go out of the Champions League, but I think it's not a terrible time for them to exit that competition and sort of refocus on domestic matters.
Fair enough. Jules says on the subject of, he's an Arsenal fan, should players be fitted with explosive neck braces like Battle Royal or Running Man that activate after their third consecutive blatant offside?
Well, I mean, you fear for Jermaine Defoe, certainly. I mean, throughout his career, that would have been very bad.
Well, he would have had a shorter...
Pippo and Zaghi wouldn't have had it.
He'd have had a shorter career, that's for sure. Perhaps not exploding, but, you know, a sort of shock, some sort of electric shock for constantly being offside.
And just in terms of the... completely changing the subject, in terms of the top four, Arsenal, they don't have... As far as I can see, they've only got United left out of the top. They've got very few games against top six teams left. And their results this season, by and large, have been good, apart from against the big teams. So I think I wouldn't be actually surprised if Arsenal could sneak into the top four here now.
And to go back to the question I refused to answer earlier, it's hard to see Manchester United not finishing the top four the way their momentum is going at the moment.
Tottenham going away to Liverpool, going away to City. You know, it's not a brilliant...
I could see Spurs finishing outside the top four. Mauricio Pochettino going to Real Madrid. There was talk this morning, actually, in the papers. I don't know how true it is that Florentino Perez is jetting into London this week to have talks with him. They may just be talking about old times or the weather or... the price of fish, I don't know. But and then possibly Harry Kane deciding he wants to leave as well, which I think possibly wouldn't be a terrible thing to happen to Spurs if they got loads and loads of money for them. Bournemouth, or for him.
Yeah, Bournemouth 0, Manchester City 1. 5 wins in a row since that defeat at Newcastle. The most exciting thing is Bournemouth's expected goals from this game. 0.00. Kyle Walker completed 106 passes. Bournemouth completed 100. But you can understand Bournemouth actually setting up defensively, John, after that they've lost quite a few games to the top sides quite heavily.
Yeah, and Eddie Howe is someone who came into the Premier League as a reputation for always going for it in matches, has over the years changed himself into a far more pragmatic manager. I must have looked at those defeats, the Arsenal one, and thought, OK, we need to sit on this. And they frustrated City for quite a lot of the game. Mahrez's goal was due to very highly unconvincing goalkeeping from dear old Artur Boruch. If we're talking about the title race, Manchester City look nervy themselves. And I tell you who else looks nervy, and actually he always looks nervy, Pep Guardiola. After the game, his celebration was a little too wild for a 1-0 win at Bournemouth.
Is Pep feeling it too, Lars?
I mean, I think it's exciting that we have something that looks like a proper title race. Like, we've not really had that recently, and I thought after this weekend both the managers in charge seem to be not entirely chilled out about the situation, and I think that'll make for great entertainment going forward.
I think Guardiola, though, I mean, you know, going back to the Amazon documentary, this is a guy that can get himself het up against. You go to the Alex Ferguson thing with the lads at Tottenham and be relaxed against certain opposition, and knowing, oscillating between relaxed and on it when he really needed to be, and the players responding to that. I think one of the things that might count against Manchester City is the intensity that with which Pep treats every game, with which he treated last season. So he pushed them to get 100 points when it wasn't really that necessary because they were going to win the league anyway. And they are carrying something of a hangover this season, I think. Kevin De Bruyne would be the prime example of that, picking up plenty of injuries. Now he's got another muscle injury. And that team of last season, which was almost perfect, doesn't look quite so perfect this season.
Another fun stat, Bournemouth's three substitutes, Moussa, Ibe and Diego Rico, were on the pitch for a combined 41 minutes and completed just one pass between them. and Barry and I agree completely on the absolute high point of this game, don't we?
Oh, the Vincent Kompany header from sort of halfway inside his own half that travelled about 50 metres.
I mean, he headed it further than most humans can kick a football. It was launched an attack.
Yeah,
it
was
like
he was
a
trying
volley.
To put Sterling through on goal, wasn't he? Because whoever was defending the header didn't deal with it very well. Because I think they were also caught on the hop by just how powerful it was. And, yeah, whatever is in his neck.
Well, you can go to the gym. You can do... How do you get a strong neck?
You do those things where you hang from the neck, don't you? Those...
What?
Well,
you, I you think say that's when, how you
when,
die.
No, when boxers... I remember seeing that Nigel Benn and right. Chris Eubank, because mm-hmm. you need strength in your neck to obviously be able to take a punch, yeah. and they sort of hang things from the neck and, you know, work the muscles around.
Oh, I see. Just increasing weights on your neck.
Yeah.
Well, doesn't sound like my favourite Monday afternoon, I'll be honest. That'll do.
Give it a go, Barry. Give it a go. Give it a go.
Let's see you come in with a giant neck. It's always a worrying sign, isn't it, where men who go to the gym so much that their neck is bigger than their head. It's the same as the ones who can't put their arms down,
yeah.
you know, and they get that big. If you are.
My favourite are the ones who never do any leg work and then, you know, they've got really butch, muscly upper bodies and then little spindly legs.
What's nice is there'll be lots of people listen to the pod, obviously, in the gym. There'll be people probably like that, thinking I should probably go onto the leg press now. Barry has unveiled me. Just finally with City, we're going to do something on Thursday about Der Spiegel and the latest thing about City and FFP. Nick Harris at Sporting Intel has been getting a lot of flack from some potentially myopic Manchester City fans about these stories, John.
Yes, Nick's problem, I would suggest, is that Nick knows quite a lot about this stuff, a forensic journalist, an excellent journalist, and I suppose we wait to see what comes of this, but there are a few Manchester City fans afraid of what might happen if the Der Spiegel allegations are proved correct and how UEFA might react towards that. If I may say, there's no excuse for some of the stuff that Nick's received. He's just doing his job as a journalist.
Mm-hmm. Look, we talked about the one-eyed tribalism of football fans, Barry, ad nauseam. It is interesting how, regardless of what's happened to your football team, you can find a way to defend it, right?
Well, many of these City fans, they take grave exception to what seems to be a blatant breach of the rules being pointed out. They're either stupid or willfully pretending to be stupid or being willfully ignorant of what's going on. But, we'll see what happens.
We will.
We'll talk more about it on Thursday.
Yeah, hopefully. We will. That'll do for part one. In part two, we'll begin at Old Trafford.
It's time to focus.
I think ultimately that ideology is fading, but it will have a sting in the tail, and we see that sometimes with these flare-ups and violence.
Today in Focus is the new daily podcast from The Guardian. Join me, Anoushka Astana, for the best stories from our journalists around the world. Subscribe now to Today in Focus from The Guardian.
Welcome to part two of the Guardian Football Weekly. Thanks to everyone who bought a ticket for the 15th of March at Earth in Hackney, a sellout. Me, Barry, Greg Bukowski, David Squires. We're pleased to announce two more shows coming up next month. Thanks very much. Dave says, when's the pod going to visit Scotland? We're going to do it on the 22nd of April, Glasgow. So bring an extended fit bar corner, Barry. I'm looking forward to the pelters you're going to get. Ewan Murray joins us, and one other, as yet to be confirmed. And then on the 23rd of April, we are flying straight to Belfast. Me, you, Ewan Murray, and Lars Sivertsen.
Ah!
Did you know about this?
I did.
Excellent news.
Exciting stuff.
We had a lot.
I have been to Belfast before. Okay. That was many years ago for a sort of a brass band European championship thing.
Where did you come with your euphonium?
No, I wasn't there. I was just listening.
Oh, really?
My sister was in it.
Oh, I see. How did she get? Well, she's like the third best.
I think they did well. They're very good.
What's she, the third best trombonist in Norway?
Not at all.
What is it?
The cornet. And she's not the third best in Norway. That's very offensive to many other. Yes.
I apologise to all brass players. Yeah, my ignorance.
Yeah.
Let's go to Old Trafford then. Manchester United 3. Southampton 2.
Bruin and I are sniggering like schoolboys.
I know why.
That is all. Sister and her tromboning.
Anyway, behave yourself. Manchester United 3, Southampton 2. What a great game. Do you want me to go to you, Barry, or should I go to someone else? Let you compose yourself. Are you ready?
Probably go to someone.
Okay, fine. Manchester United 3, Southampton 2. What a game, John. What so many great goals. Which was the best one?
Well, the Jan Valery strike was superb, but Pereira's was... When he hits it, you don't know how it can actually end up in that corner of the goal. Mm. So I'm going to go for that. He clearly enjoyed it very much. But also, you've got to talk about, is it Lukaku's first goal where he cuts in and a deadly finish with his right foot? And he has been noticeably a very left-footed player. And it's amazing what happens when a player works with a manager who knows what it's like to play up front and coaches forward players. Now, I'm not even going to mention the name of the previous guy that didn't do anything to coach the forward players, but Ole Gunnar Solskjaer has made a difference to every one of those attacking players at Manchester United, and that's why Manchester United are able to get themselves out of predicaments like they found against Southampton.
I mean, because he got two against Palace and two here. Were they all with his right foot? Am I misremembering?
I think it might be three out of four or something like that.
But that is a you're absolutely right. It's a real sign of what coaching a footballer can do, Lars.
Strange days indeed. I mean, some people have noted that in terms of the old XG, Ole Gunnar Solskjaer has gotten a lot more points than maybe they should have. I mean, they've had games where they've conceded a considerable number of chances as well, and they've been quite efficient. But I do wonder if this is where the sort of stats things reach a certain dead end, because it can't be a coincidence that when players are feeling better about themselves and are being told that they're good rather than being told that they're rubbish, then suddenly they're more likely to take their chances when they appear. Like, I think there might be a connection there.
Well, the thing is with Solskjaer as a striker, I remember a stat of him as a natural player, which was, I think, in his first season at United, of his shots, 75% of them were on target, and the next best would be Alan Shearer, say, on 50. And something, clearly the players hit I don't know how XG works properly, but I imagine if you hit the ball on target, you're going to have a better chance of scoring.
You'd think so.
And that does seem to have changed for Manchester United. They are scoring goals. And have confidence in attacking, and have confidence that if they chase a goal, they will score, which is something that they certainly weren't doing previously.
Southampton seem to have shown enough. If it does turn out to be a straight fight between them and Cardiff for the third relegation spot, you'd imagine Southampton will come clear.
You'd think so. I mean, Ralph Hasenhüttl, when he came first, there were immediate signs of huge improvement after the departure of Mark Hughes. Then they stagnated a bit. You know, they had the bounce at first, but that was a really good performance against Manchester United, and they possibly deserved something from the game. I think they deserved at least a point. If they continue to play like that, they should stay up quite easily, because they'll play a lot worse teams than Man U. But will they continue to play like that? I don't know. Or were they just raising their game because it was at Old Trafford? But there were brave tactics by Hasenhüttl, and they almost paid off.
How many penalties would there have been if this game was played next season? Look at you, roll your eyes.
Just leave it alone.
But I mean, but
there
actually
might have been a couple.
But,
yeah,
but
sure.
Actually, it's interesting because I do wonder
would the game be over yet?
Well, that's true. But you may sneer, Lars. But will there be more? I'm just trying to think. Will VAR change to such a degree that there'll be no shirt pulling in the box? Because you've got to stop doing it, right? Because those decisions would go to VAR and they would be given as penalties.
Yeah, that's a fair point. That's a fair point, Max. And I thought, for instance, the penalty in the Man City-Schalke game was interesting in that regard, because that was a fairly sort of innocuous shove in the box that I think would happen a lot normally. But players are just going to have to accept that with VAR, there's a risk they'll get pulled up on it. And that could definitely change the way teams defend. That's a very interesting point. And I think another thing about VAR coming in, I'm quite agnostic about it, but presumably it will eradicate the very worst tackles, like the proper sort of reducers that you put in thinking you'll probably get away with it, because you know it's extremely unlikely that you will get away with it. So having VAR there might actually make the game a little bit safer for the players as well.
Away to PSG United on Wednesday night. They're 2-0 down, so they will do very well to win that. What's going on with PSG in the meantime, Lars?
They won at the weekend against Caen, having been down. Kylian Mbappe turned up and scored two goals. And Kylian Mbappe, again, just looking really good in the absence of Neymar. And it's a bit of a sort of superficial conclusion that I'm sure a lot of Neymar fans will aggressively disagree with. But you do wonder if the boy wonder is slightly better for them when Neymar's not around. And maybe long term, he's the safer bet as terms of who you want to be the focal point of that team going forward. And can I just, on a linguistic point, Ole Gunnar Solskjaer described this game as a very difficult mountain to climb, which I think is excellent, because as a non-native English speaker, I always found the metaphor a mountain to climb very unsatisfying, because some mountains are not that hard to climb. I mean, they're not all that steep and hard to get up. So I feel like that is a metaphor you need to add for it to make sense, that the mountain is very difficult.
What's the highest mountain you've climbed?
Not a very high one, Max, okay. But that's not the point. I think Ole Gunnar Solskjaer is doing us all a favour there by clearing up what is a deeply unsatisfying metaphor.
Fulham 1, Chelsea 2. Claudio Ranieri was sacked after we finished recording on Thursday. Was anyone surprised, Baz?
No, don't think so. Archie was in, and I think he spoke for most Fulham fans when he pointed out that he had no effect there at all. You can't help but feel, I don't know how Scott Parker is going to get on, but they immediately showed a bit more fight, determination, passion yesterday. That will obviously only get you so far, but it'll get you a long way. And the mountain Fulham need to climb is Everestian.
K2, yeah.
They need their grappling hooks. But I think perhaps if they'd given it Scotty instead of Ranieri, they might have had a chance to save themselves, but it's too late now.
Jokanović was Ranieri's first Chelsea signing, and Ranieri went on to replace him as Fulham manager. Now Ranieri's been replaced by Scott Parker, who is his final signing as Chelsea manager. What does that mean? Anything I'm trying to work out? Does that mean the first signing that Scott Parker makes will one day be the Fulham manager or not?
Yeah.
Okay.
But, you know, there were immediate changes. He had Sessegnon was playing on the right wing. Kevin McDonald was brought in from the cold. Tom Kearney was playing in centre mid rather than out in the wing, where, you know, which is his best position. They were all integral parts of the Fulham team that won promotion. So.
It's almost as if Claudio Ranieri's coaches sat there and thought, what on earth is he doing with that team selection, when it was happening week on week? Ranieri, as Archie said last week, completely could not work out that group of players. And there's no disgrace in that, because they seem to have been collected particularly chaotically. But Scott Parker already, just in that 90 minutes, and they were perhaps a little unlucky not to draw, seems to have made more sense of it.
Callum Chambers with his fourth Premier League goal, all under four different managers: Wenger, Agnew, Ranieri and Parker. So Scott didn't really want him to score that early, because that means he'll be on his way. Lovely finish from Higuain. Watford 2, Leicester 1. Andre Gray, in the final minute of injury time, made a disappointing start for Brendan Rodgers there, Barry.
Yeah, I'm not sure why, but I just thought that was really funny. But I suspect it wasn't a fairy tale beginning to his tenure at Leicester that Brendan was hoping for. I think he'll do a good job there, to be honest. But Watford are a funny old team. They're capable of real excellence. And, you know, they scored very early doors in that game with a header we saw. We were watching it and thought it was that free kick was undefendable, really. It was brilliant. And then very late doors, which was a bit of a kick in the nice, shiny teeth for Brendan. And I reckon he'll do a good job. And as I say, Watford hammered by Liverpool midweek, win that game with a good performance. You were at it, Lars. So
I was there. I really enjoyed it. It was great fun at Vicarage Road, I thought. I was a little bit surprised to see Brendan Rodgers go for a three-man backline in his first game. I mean, he took over midweek. He can't have had a lot of time on the training ground to work with this team. It's not a formation the players are used to playing at all, and it's quite a different way of playing than compared to having a back four. So I thought that was quite a bold move. In the first half, it looked like they were struggling a little bit to come to grips with it, figuring out what exactly their roles were and where they were meant to pass the ball and this sort of thing. But they grew into the game. They stuck with it. And certainly in the second half, they were getting the ball wider, quicker, which is what that formation is about to a great extent. And you think, in the long term, having like Maddison and Tielemans, certainly to the end of the season, playing through balls to Jamie Vardy is not a bad recipe for success. But Watford were very good. I really enjoyed their sort of physically robust approach to the thing. I was sat very close to what must surely have been the angriest Watford fan in the world. I hope so, because if there's an angrier one out there, then I feel for him, who got very, very exercised about really all manner of decisions being made by Mr. Moss. But I mean, they do play in quite a physically robust way, Watford. Some of their players are quite happy to mix it up in a way that referees sometimes will let go and sometimes not. So I suppose this referee, yeah.
We were talking about big necks. I mean, when Andre Gray takes his shirt off, and you think, wow. And he's like the little of the little and large striking partnership. Do we give Watford enough credit? Because I feel we've talked a lot about Wolves and how good they've been. And Watford are level on points with them. They are both the two favourites for the Everton Cup. That could get you into the Europa League next season. John, can you redress the balance for the pride of Hertfordshire?
I've seen a bit of Watford this season. As Barry said, I think they can be excellent at times. And actually, you flick through the team and they've got real talent there. Will Hughes, Delafeu, Troy Deeney is a very highly canny striker. And Andre Gray's finish straight through the gap that Brendan's three at the back had left him was excellent. Watford over the years have stockpiled players such that you sometimes wonder, like, where's this player come from? And it's obscure, but eventually it sort of boiled down to this team, which is, I think, probably had a better season than Wolves because they've done it on a little less of a budget, haven't they?
West Ham 2, Newcastle 0. Billy Bond's stand was opened. 799 appearances for West Ham is a truly extraordinary record.
I think it's very sad he didn't get 800. I think he got a knee injury that finished his career at 41. I was reading about this yesterday.
Could they just bring him on in the last game if there's nothing to play for?
Yeah, I mean, Billy Bonds is one of those players. About the time I started following football, Billy Bonds was sort of a legendary figure, and then he just kept suddenly reappearing and playing for West Ham. Like he missed the season they finished third in the first division. He missed the entire season with a toe injury. Now, his toe injury was so bad that he actually asked the doctors to cut off his toe so that he could keep playing. So Billy Bonds, you know, amongst West Ham, he is the ultimate hammer.
And I don't know if, because I was watching it on Sunday morning and I'd been out quite late and I get a bit emotional if I've got a hangover, but I found it quite moving. You know, he was clearly moved. You see a lot of these kind of, someone unveils something and everyone goes claps, and it's rare that you see someone that it actually seems to mean a lot to them.
Yeah, it clearly did mean a lot to him. I tell you, it also seemed to mean a lot to Mark Noble, who cited him as a hero. And Mark Noble is the current Mr. West Ham. And they pointed out on Match of the Day, I think it was, that he has another 300-odd appearances to go before he gets to 799, which just shows you what an achievement it has been for Billy Bonds.
Joel says, is there any other footballer that looks like they should play for their club as much as Noble does? His hair, face, just screams West Ham to me. And then he says, this is definitely a Rushton-style question. I don't understand why you think that. But he does have a good point, doesn't he? Or are we conditioned by the fact that Mark Noble's always played for West Ham?
He did play for Millwall on loan. Oh. He suits that as well, actually. I always thought Jordan Pickford fitted Sunderland.
Yeah, maybe. Oh, if you have any more thoughts, you can put them below the line. On the pitch, good header from Declan Rice from a corner and a great penalty from Noble. England squad's going to be announced pretty soon, next week, I think. I'd like to point out as well on how emotional I was on Sunday. I also slightly welled up watching a video of a raccoon eating some prunes. So, that was the level
pretty
I was at.
Stuff.
It was really fun. I've tweeted the video out. It's quite...
I got a bit emotional watching Troy Deeney at Vicarage Road.
Did you?
I just thought there's something about It's easy to write him off as this sort of, yeah, he puts himself about a bit. But just sitting on sort of a slightly wet and windy morning in Watford, watching this guy just hair about the pitch, you know, pushing people over, but also showing like little details of really good football. I really enjoyed it. It's absolutely worth it. There was one moment when he was on a yellow card, and of course putting himself about is a big part of what he does. He was on a yellow card and he'd been chasing a ball that was just sort of shepherded out of play, where he just randomly pushed the defender over after the ball had gone out. And I was just thinking, you've already been booked. Like, why would you do this? And the ref came over. I think the ref would have feared for his personal safety if he'd given him a second yellow. Such was the mood at Vicarage Road. But he gave over and had a word like, I don't know what he said. I just imagine saying, I really don't want to send you off for any reason, so please don't give me reasons.
Burnley 1, Crystal Palace 3. Lars, a question for you. I noticed after the game, Sean Dyche said, statistically, we had a good game. And given you've spent about 2 years saying, statistically, they never have good games, I wondered if you found any irony in this.
Well, I hadn't seen those comments, so I haven't really looked up the XG as such, but they had a lot of shots. This is very un-Burnley-like. I see this here now. They had a bunch of shots, so clearly they lost. I mean, that's not their method. They're meant to not have any shots and then win mysteriously.
The main point from this game is the Wilfried Zaha goal. I mean, turning everyone inside out, including someone filming it in the stadium, went that way when Zaha went that way. It was a lovely goal, John, wasn't it?
It was, yes. And I wrote a little piece in the paper this morning talking about how Batshuayi's arrival has coincided with Wilfried Zaha's revival in form. And again, it's another piece of Chelsea buy-to-let thing where they buy a player and he becomes a lot more used to another club. And we've talked quite a lot over the season about how Chelsea could do with a striker. I'm not saying Batshuayi is the answer, but surely he could be a bit more used to Chelsea than becoming a better player for Wilfried Zaha.
He didn't have leather that shot, did he, where he scored?
Oh, yeah.
That ball stayed hit.
Interesting to note that Palace have actually got the best away record outside the top six this season. So we tend to think of them as having this real fortress in Selhurst Park that's an awful place to go, but they're actually the second worst home team in the league this year. But their away record is really strong, which does kind of make sense when you've got the pace of like Zaha and Townsend. You know, Schlupp is quite quick. They've got a lot of players you don't want to come up against in terms of being countered at.
Wolves 2, Cardiff 0. Two early goals. I guess Neil Warnock could be a bit annoyed that Ryan Bennett could have got and probably should have got sent off in the first half, but it was already 2-0 then.
My take from the game was, yes, Bennett should have been sent off, but he wasn't. I'm not sure why. It clearly were two bookable offences, but there you go, these things happen. I think Wolves probably would have won anyway. Cardiff seemed to spend a lot of this game ball-watching and were at times a bit mesmerised by the Wolves players. I think two good goals, two excellent goals, and a fantastic save from Etheridge towards the end.
Oh, yeah. Unbelievable,
wasn't it? That was a remarkable save.
Was that better than Leno's from Sissoko? Because they were both
top drawer. I'd say, on its merits, Etheridge's was probably better.
Lars, you had your hand up.
Yeah, a couple of weeks ago, I'd made my peace with the idea that Cardiff were going to stay off, that this sort of Warnock thing was working and that's how we were going. And since then, they've lost three on the bounce and they've been un-Cardiff-like games from all I can tell, in the sense they've not made it that hard for the opponent. I mean, they've always been this slightly nasty team to play against. And the worry for them is that, is the old saying, you don't have to outswim the shark, you just have to outswim your sister. Like, so the problem for Cardiff is that the teams around them, Southampton are looking pretty good now, and Burnley and Brighton both look like they're more likely to pick up points. So bad times for Cardiff at the moment.
Your sister's obviously very good with a cornet. Is she a good swimmer as well?
She's a better swimmer than me.
She'd
sure,
be weighed so down by the trombone.
Brighton 1, Huddersfield 0. Late goal, Andone's late goal won it. Boring game, John, but huge win for Brighton.
Huge, yes, and a good header. I was beginning to get nervous about Brighton. When I've looked at Brighton this season, they've reminded me actually of Chris Hughton's spell as Norwich manager, where first season came up and everyone talks about what a great guy and a great manager Chris Hughton is, and then things fall away when, if you remember at Norwich, they bought Ricky van Wolfswinkel and a load of other players that didn't work out. And at Brighton, they bought a hell of a lot of players. Not many of them have worked out. I think Brighton will get away from it this season. But I think in Chris Hughton, what you have is a manager where essentially managers have a finite existence. and then sometimes it starts to go a bit awry. And I would be surprised if Hughton is at Brighton at the end of next season, just because that's the way it goes with management. It's not everybody can be Arsene Wenger or Alex Ferguson.
Are you saying Chris Hughton is not infinite?
I am, yes.
Okay. In the Football League, Derby County managed just three shots, all off target, as Aston Villa beat them 4-0, all four goals in the first half. The last of the four, Jack Grealish, that sort of Scholes volley from a corner, isn't it? Glenn Whelan pinged a beautiful ball, and he just smashed it in. It's just two wins for Derby since Bielsa unveiled exactly how they play in that press conference.
Do we worry for Frank Lampard's future? Because Derby tend not to be patient with managers who don't at least get them into the playoffs, and they desperately want to be back in the Premier League.
I reckon.
But I still think it would be rather unfair to say Lampard hasn't done well. But yeah, things aren't good. Losing 4-0 to Villa is not good.
Unless there's bizarre things going on behind the scenes that we're not privy to, it'd be completely daft to even consider sacking him, surely. Like, it's a really difficult league, the Championship, and you're handing it.
They are notoriously impatient.
You hand a really sort of smart, highly rated young guy his first job in management, and you give him, like, a season to figure out this league. I mean, Norwich, I'm sure, were not wild about where they were going under Daniel Farke last season around about this time. Yeah, it's worked out for them. Sometimes you need to give the manager a bit of time to build something, I think.
Leeds blew fourth place West Brom away 4-0 at Ellen Road on Friday night. Pablo Hernandez scoring after just 16 seconds. That put them top, but Norwich reclaimed the lead on Saturday with a 3-1 win at Millwall. Sheffield United are third, 3 points behind Leeds with a game in hand. It's the Sheffield derby tonight at Hillsborough. You're clenching your fists.
I just like that fixture.
Yeah.
I lived in Sheffield for a few years. Real needle in that game. Like the Everton-Liverpool game, the quality of football might not be that good, but the tension makes up for it.
In League One, yet another win for Luton, this time 2-0 over Rochdale. They're 5 points ahead of second place Barnsley, who won 3-0 at Southend, despite having a man sent off with the score at 0-0 after 35 minutes. Must have been nice to be a Southend fan. You get so excited when the opposition have an early red card, and then you go and lose 3-0. Barnsley unbeaten in 15. Sunderland third with a game in hand on the two above them. Are you excited, Barry?
I'm beside myself with excitement. Yeah, they beat Plymouth 2-0. James Dart, who works on the sports desk and is a friend of the pod, he's a Plymouth fan. He was saying they took 1,700 to the Stadium of Light. That's an 804-mile round trip from stadium to stadium.
We got a message from Frank Zelko. I know you've said it before, but he says, "Aloha. From a listener in Hawaii, I've been listening to Barry for years. Still don't know why he's a Sunderland fan. Family connection, ? A famous Irish player who played for them during the 70s. Not that he necessarily needs a rational reason. I've been a Liverpool fan for 40 years, despite being born and raised in Melbourne, having no family connection to Britain, and having only visited Liverpool once in my life. Still, I am curious."
It's a bit of both, really. My dad's a Sunderland fan. He's a Sunderland fan because the great Charlie Hurley, former Irish international, after whom Sunderland's training ground is named, or academy, one or the other.
Okay. In League Two, the top four all won, so it's as you were for Lincoln, Bury, Mansfield, and MK Dons. The Colin Calderwood revolution is back on after Cambridge's fine 2-0 victory at Grimsby. And a great stat sent in by listener Chris Davis about Wrexham in the National League. They're top by 5 points, having played two more games than second place Leighton Orient. They don't have a single player who's scored more than 5 goals in the league this season. After getting that email, producer Jonathan did a bit of digging. Not only is that true, the only player who scored 5 goals for Wrexham in the league is Raquel Pike, who was on loan from Huddersfield for the season but left the club in January to move up to Rochdale in League One. Wrexham are the only team in the entire division who don't have a single player who scored more than 5 goals in the league.
Do you think if Raquel Pike is getting booked by a referee and the referee asks for his name, his captain go, "Don't tell him, Pike"?
Stupid boy.
I should hope so.
There's something almost similar going on at Valencia, where they only have one player who scored more than five, and that's midfielder Dani Parejo, who scored 6. So there's a reason that, I mean, they have something like 15 draws this season, Valencia, because they just did not score in goals. It's very bad for them.
Before we finish part two, Barry, a little bit of FitBar.
Yeah, it was the majority of the action in Scotland was Scottish Cup quarterfinals, so Celtic went through against Hibs. Neil Lennon's good start continues, 2 wins out of 2. Aberdeen and Rangers drew at Pittodrie, Inverness from the Scottish Championship went through to the semi-final at the expense of Dundee United, also from the Championship. And Partick Thistle from the second division take on Hearts tonight. With a place in the semi-final up for grabs, but once again, Scottish football fans disgracing themselves is, you know, the talk of the weekend, and it's basically a throwing things at each other and whataboutery special again. It's getting very tedious, to be honest. Scott Sinclair had a glass Buckfast bottle thrown at him while he was waiting to take a corner. He had a coin thrown at him. Celtic fans threw a flare on the pitch. And Celtic are also facing a bill for 80 seats that were destroyed by their fans at Easter Road, which comes on the back of them having had to stump up for seats their fans damaged at Rugby Park earlier this season. And Hibs issued a statement after the bottle was thrown at Scott Sinclair and said, "We'll review CCTV footage, work with the appropriate authorities, blah, blah, blah." But even, no, not only are Scottish football fans masters at it, but Hibs in their statement engaged in some whataboutery.
Are you serious?
Yeah. Oh, yeah. "We understand two bottles were thrown, one from each set of supporters. This is entirely unacceptable and puts players and others at risk." So Celtic have asked for evidence of any of their fans, or further details of any of their fans throwing a bottle, and none has been forthcoming so far. But it's getting ridiculous, you know. So as well as those incidents I've already mentioned, Hearts goalkeeper Zenik Zamal had a coin thrown at him by Celtic fans on Wednesday. Kilmarnock's Chris Boyd was hit by a coin thrown by a Celtic fan. Linesman Callum Spence was hit in the head and left bloodied by a coin thrown by a Rangers fan. And Neil Lennon was hit by a coin thrown by a Hibs fan. A Hearts fan. And it's just...
Stop throwing things at people.
Yes.
Thank you.
It's nice for Scottish football fans that so many of them are rich enough to be able to throw coins, and yet poor enough to be only able to drink Buckfast. It's
But Barry, have you ever tried Buckfast?
I have indeed, yes.
I've never had the pleasure.
No, me neither.
In a previous life, I used to do stand-up comedy, and I was performing at a... I don't know if you're aware, there's the Buckfast Triangle, which is, I think, Galway, Belfast, and Glasgow,
yeah.
And the triangle. So that's where people basically drink Buckfast, which is a kind of fortified wine made by monks somewhere.
Somewhere in England, isn't it?
Yeah. But anyway, I was performing, doing a set at this comedy club in Galway run by a guy called Jerry Mallon one night, and... every comedian who performed, apart from the teetotal ones who were off the drink because they were alcoholic, quite a lot of them in the world of comedy, yeah. Jerry would force you at the end of your set to drink half a pint of Buckfast on stage. And is filth.
Anyway, I hope you all look forward to our live show in Glasgow. Coming up, do buy your tickets.
I will neck half a pint of Buckfast if it goes well.
Oh, great.
If people promise not to throw lighters and coins and bottles at me.
Okay, I won't. I'll just have a glass of wine. That'll do for part two. We'll start part three with Sid in Spain. Welcome to part three of the Guardian Football Weekly. Let's start in Spain with Sid Lowe. Sid, how are you doing?
Very well, thank you. How are you?
Yeah, marvellous, thanks. Let's start with El Clasico then. Barcelona ahead now of Real Madrid for the first time in, 80-odd years or something?
87 years. 96 Clasicos they've won, 96 Clasicos Madrid have won. And I think what that tells you, in a way, is that this is about more than just this Clasico. Now, obviously, it's about this Clasico in the sense that it leaves Real Madrid 12 points behind, plus the head-to-head goal difference, which, of course, they can't overturn now. So it's effectively 13 points. And Barcelona would have to lose. I mean, Barcelona could lose four times between now and the end of the season in the next 12 games, and still Real Madrid wouldn't be able to catch them. And there's a sense of that. There's a sense of the significance of Madrid in a week in which they had three tournaments, knocked out the Copa by Barcelona, 3 days later effectively knocked out the league by Barcelona, and now they have Ajax coming up, admittedly with a 2-1 lead from the first leg. So they probably would still expect to go through. But I think it was more about that sense that this reaffirmed the idea of the dominance of Barcelona over this last decade. I mean, to put this into context, now they may well not win the league, because although they have this huge lead over Real Madrid, their lead over Atletico is not so big. It's only 7 points, and they don't have that head-to-head advantage, and they still got to play Atletico, so there's an opportunity there. But if they were to win the league, Barcelona, it would be 8 out of the last 11, with only 2 for Real Madrid. They've also won, I think it's 6 of the last 10 Copa del Reyes, with another place in the final this year. And there's this curious sense that, you know, Real Madrid have been the best team in Europe over the last 5 years, winning 4 of the last 5 Champions League, when they haven't even been the best team in Spain. And not just not the best team in Spain, but they've been absolutely dominated by Barcelona over this last decade. And this 87-year change, I think, reinforces that. You know, this is a team that, I think, since 48, when Bernabeu was inaugurated, I think Barcelona had only won 12 games there until 2004. In other words, until Messi arrived on the scene. They've won 12 since then. So, you know, what they couldn't do in all that time, or what they only just managed to do in all that time, they've done with Messi in a little over a decade.
Does that mean, I mean, is there like an impending or a growing sense of complete panic or sort of devastation around Real Madrid because of this?
No, I mean, it's curious because, I mean, I had slightly strange sensations watching the game at the weekend and then watching the fallout as well, because there was a sense of sort of almost of normality about it. It was curious that it wasn't a bigger deal. You know, the celebrations from Barcelona, obviously, they did celebrate on the pitch. They jump up and down and celebrate with the fans. But even that felt a little bit like, OK, well, this is kind of what we do. On to the next thing. I think partly because both of these two teams' seasons will be defined by Europe, as is always the case, because Europe eclipses everything. I think the fact that Madrid have won 4 Champions Leagues in 5 years, obviously, I mean, this sounds ridiculous because, I mean, that's just, you know, that's the second best record ever in the Champions League behind their own from the 50s. But that sort of palliates the pain, which, as I say, is a stupid thing to say, but I think it slightly disguises the reality domestically, at least. And yet, of course, it is a reality in itself. So there is a sense that Real Madrid have significant problems they need to deal with. They're not scoring the goals that, obviously, they had done in previous seasons with Ronaldo. Although, again, it's worth insisting on this. Ronaldo only won 2 league titles as well. You know, and that, in 9 seasons, is a relatively poor return. So there are some underlying issues. I think there is a sense that Barcelona are a genuine big and as big as Real Madrid force now. But that's not necessarily to say that Real Madrid think, well, that's it, it's screwed, we've been caught, they're better than us. I don't think anyone thinks that. But I think there is an awareness now that you know, there is an argument that says over the last 15 years they are not the best team anymore.
In Sergio Ramos news, he could have seen red for pushing Messi in the face, and he's got this 2-match ban now for getting that deliberate yellow in the Champions League.
Yeah, it's obviously the ban that he was going to get automatically, plus an extra one for having deliberately looked for the card. That means, of course, that he misses the Ajax game. It means he would miss the first game in the next round if they go through, which, I mean, they would still anticipate going through. Ramos, I mean, the thing about this, what really was, that Ramos got the card and then was daft enough to admit it after the game. And then the following day, he tried to kind of pretend he hadn't said that. He said, no, I wasn't saying I was looking for the card. I was saying I was looking for the foul. I mean, it really was kind of almost like, you know, Sergio Ramos is not at war with Eurasia today. He's more at war with Oceania and always has been. And it was just this kind of desperate attempt to twist the language. But it was never going to work. He got the ban. It's very bad news for Ramos. It's not necessarily because of defending. And I think this weekend probably flagged up something that while people talk about Ramos and don't really talk about PK, maybe PK over the last decade has been the better defender. But, of course, Ramos has this incredible power of personality with Real Madrid, and I think it's really, really important, his absence. I think it, emotionally and psychologically, I think it plays a really, really big part in them. Obviously, he's been huge in these last 5 seasons in the Champions League. I don't think I've ever seen a defender be as influential, perhaps except Marcelo last season, anyway. And yeah, it's quite a big deal. Actually, in terms of this weekend, by the way, I mean, it was a very, very deliberate forearm smash. Now, I suppose if someone else had done it, you might say, well, I'm not so sure. But it was Ramos.
Hey, he's not that kind of player, Sid. Atletico beat Real Sociedad 2-0. 2-2 for Morata. 3-2 for him now. Days. But it seems that he was actually quite good at football after all.
Well, but I mean, correct me if I'm wrong, because obviously I'm in Spain and I sort of see this a little bit less directly. But didn't it turn out that he was really quite good for Chelsea, at least to start with? Wasn't the start really quite good at Chelsea?
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, I think the question mark will be how he responds when things go badly, and whether he can maintain this kind of level of kind of aggressiveness in the way that he plays, whether he sort of turns in on himself a little bit, because there is that slight touch of kind of psychological vulnerability about him. And obviously, you know, he's probably in a better place in terms of the support around him and playing in Madrid and the kind of manager that he's got. So, yeah, certainly to start with, at least, there's quite a lot of optimism about him.
And just finally, Sergei Samper, former highly rated youth player at Barcelona, has just had his contract terminated ahead of a move to Vissel Kobe, where he'll join Iniesta, David Villa and Lucas Podolski in his kebabs. What's happened there?
What's happened there, in truth, is very, very simple. A lot of injuries. I feel very sorry for Sergio Santos. He's a player who we all thought was going to be very good. I was not quite as enamoured of him as other people, but certainly a really talented midfielder, very much in the Barcelona mold. But he's had dreadful injuries. And I suppose anyone who's watched him play or anyone who's known anything about him over the last 7 or 8 years would say, the only thing anyone can really ask for is that he plays and he gets a chance to play and that he stays injury-free. And then who knows? Maybe if things go very well, maybe if he can get some continuity, he can come back again, not necessarily to Barcelona, but to a decent club. Because the talent's there, but the luck certainly hasn't been.
Sid, thanks for your time.
My pleasure. Cheers.
Sid Lowe, out in Spain, from Spain to Germany. No Archie. He's spending today recovering from the excesses of the Cologne Carnival. He's that wasted that he can't even do a phone call. I mean, it's ridiculous.
I've been to the Cologne Carnival.
Yeah. That's heavy, is it?
Yeah, I mean, the one thing I noticed was that everyone was drunk as monkeys and throwing and smashing glass, and the streets were strewn with glass. And then the next morning, the streets were completely pristine and everyone was straight back at work. So I don't know what's different about Archie.
Shame on you, Rin Tutt.
Means he's done it right.
Yeah. You mentioned, Dortmund, Lars, on a bit of a sticky patch, and Bayern winning.
Yeah, there's been a bit of a... feels like a pivotal weekend in the season, really, with Dortmund losing away to Augsburg on the Friday, only for Bayern to go and spank Gladbach 5-1 away. And Gladbach are not really the kind of team who tends to get spanked on their own patch. I mean, they've got the second best home record in the league, only behind Dortmund. So going there and winning 5-1, it's a real statement result from Bayern Munich. And I think I've used this line a few times. The feeling in the last couple of months have been that Borussia Dortmund was kind of leading the way, but they were kind of moving away from like a zombie horde, you know. It's like with Bayern, of course, being the zombies, it's like every time they have a little stumble, they look behind them and Bayern are that much closer, you know. That's been the feeling, and this was a big stumble this weekend, and now they're very, very close indeed. You've got zombie Frank Ribery sort of just looking at you disconcertingly there, and it's not so good. Also, intriguingly, another win for Peter Bosch at Leverkusen. The sort of reappraisal of Peter Bosch continues, widely ridiculed at Dortmund because his team was, you know, quite profoundly terrible when he was there, but he's doing really, really good job at Bayern Leverkusen now, and they're one of the teams to look out for in Europe at the moment.
I should point out that both goals for Augsburg were scored by former Sunderland striker Ji Dong-won, only Dortmund's second defeat of the season, and Robert Lewandowski scored twice, making him the joint highest foreign Bundesliga goal scorer ever with Claudio Pizarro. Pizarro recently became the oldest goal scorer in Bundesliga history, scoring a 96th minute equaliser for Werder Bremen against Hertha Berlin at the ripe old age of 40 years and 136 games. Schalke lost 4-0 to Fortuna Dusseldorf. Say again?
Just really bad. Like, I mean, it's profoundly depressing for Schalke, that result.
I like how bad it was. You couldn't even bring it to say it out loud.
Their English Twitter account at full time just tweeted something like, thank God that's over or something. Just really, really depressing.
Seven conceded, not scored since they lost to the 10 men of Manchester City. Eintracht Frankfurt keeping up a good run. They've not lost in seven now in the league, including games against Dortmund and Leipzig. They beat Hoffenheim 3-2, having been 2-1 down in the 89th minute. Paolo Bandini did not have a big night out, so he can provide us with a report on Serie A, and here it is.
Well, I think we can say that the title race is really, really over now in Italy after Juventus won 2-1 away to Napoli on Sunday night, moved them 16 points clear at the top of Serie A. Though I have to say I found it pretty underwhelming as a performance. Napoli were down to 10 men in the 25th minute when Alex Meret, the goalkeeper, got sent off. Juventus scored from the ensuing free kick and they were 2-0 up soon after that. But despite playing with a man advantage for almost 40 minutes before Miralem Pjanic got sent off for them for a ridiculously silly handball, they finished with a little more than a third of possession and they only held on to win in the end because Lorenzo Insigne missed a penalty for Napoli late on. So I thought they were pretty mediocre and really didn't see much here to make me believe that they can overturn that 2-0 deficit that they've got in the Champions League last 16 against Atletico Madrid, which of course is going to be the game that defines their season much more than an eighth consecutive Serie A title will. So that's that. The battle for the Champions League places is far more interesting, if you ask me. Milan won again and are up to third. That's the first time they've been that high in the second half of the season since 2013. Inter lost away to Cagliari one day after the still-excluded Mauro Icardi wrote a long letter on Instagram pointing out all the ways in which he has been a wonderful person who deserves better in his life. And then Lazio beat Roma 3-0. 3-0 in the derby. They hadn't beaten Roma by three goals since 2006 when their manager Delio Rossi went and took a dive in the big fountain on the Janiculum Hill to celebrate. Simone Inzaghi refused to repeat that gesture. Perhaps he was put off by the fact that back in 2006, a group of Roma fans claimed to have pissed in the fountain before Rossi jumped in. But he absolutely smashed his tactics for this game. He used Adam Maricic to force Alexander Kolarov back on the Lazio right, forced Roma to channel all their play down one flank, even as they were getting overrun in the middle of the pitch. So big, big win for Lazio, who closed within 3 points of Roma with a game in hand to get level with them in fifth place. And losing the derby for Roma is clearly huge bad news. Losing the derby is bad at any time in Rome, but this is a big, big defeat as they prepare for a huge match of their own in the Champions League away to Porto on Wednesday night. They have a 2-1 lead from the first leg, of course, and they should get Kostas Malinas back at centre-back after he missed this game with the flu. But it's not so long since they were thrashed 7-1 by Fiorentina in the Coppa Italia, a game for which Malinas played all 90 minutes, by the way. So very flaky at the back lately, and indeed all season, really. And there is talk that Eusebio Di Francesco, the manager, could lose his job if they go out.
Thank you, Paolo. In France, top four all won. As we mentioned, Kylian Mbappe scoring twice for PSG as they came from behind to beat Cannes. He's now got 50 goals for PSG in just 76 games, only 20. Mario Balotelli scored a lovely overhead kick as Marseille beat Saint-Etienne 2-0. He then grabbed a phone from someone waiting behind the goal and posted his celebration live to Instagram stories.
Was it somebody else's phone or was it his phone? We were discussing this last night. He did seem to be able to do the passcode and get in and go flick through the apps quite quickly. It was almost as if he placed the phone behind the goal with the photographer and said, if I score, I'll come and get that from
and,
you.
And do we think this is, you know, good for him? It's quite fun. Or the game's gone for me, Clive?
Well, I thought that footballers weren't really allowed to use a phone in the dressing room on match day after a certain point. So
that wasn't the dressing room, though. It was...
No, but presumably he had to, I don't know, if you're coming out to warm up and you're walking out, running out with your phone, I can't imagine any manager would be a
no,
fan of that.
No, true. I mean, not if you FaceTimed your dad, that would be nice, wouldn't it?
What, during the warm up?
Yeah, just after you scored. You know, that's a more, that's, that would be a nicer thing to do than going, you know, trying to send it to
your followers.
The
game would be delayed for a long time while my dad tried to figure out how to use FaceTime.
And then you'd just get like from his nose down to his chest. And you find you Skype your parents and you've got like half of one of them and then nothing of the other one. And then both going, this is awfully clever, isn't it? And no actual conversation. Anyway, interesting story came out last week that the LFP, the governing body of France's top two leagues, allowed Rennes to postpone their match with Nîmes on Saturday so they could better prepare to face Arsenal on Thursday. Rennes will have 7 full days to prepare for that Europa League match having last played on Wednesday. The Premier League don't do that, do they? Much to the, well, the chagrin of many Premier League sides.
Premier League seem to go out of their way to make life more difficult for various English teams in the Champions League.
Well done to Robin van Persie. 200 club goals now. 31 for Feyenoord, 96 for Arsenal, 48 to Man United, 25 for Fenerbahce. Always a big fan of anyone with grey hair playing football. So well done, RVP. In MLS, Zlatan scored the winner for LA Galaxy over Chicago Fire. Bastian Schweinsteiger was on the losing side. A 16-year-old set up the first for LA Galaxy. Which is a bit depressing. I was looking up, I mean, I clearly had nothing to do yesterday, old British players wandering around in MLS. This is far from an exhaustive list because I may have missed a couple. Stephen Caldwell, still playing for New England Revolution. They drew with FC Dallas. Michael Mancian was also an unused substitute for the Revolution. The only other Englishman I could find was a 23-year-old called Jack Elliott, who plays for Philadelphia Union.
Is Lee Ridgewell still on? Not
he,
still
he didn't seem to
he
be...
He came back. I think he's gone back over here. Alone, yeah.
He's back over here. What about BWP?
I didn't see him in the starting lineup, but as I said, I'm happy to be corrected on this.
Okay.
I don't want to say this was full investigative journalism. I think Antiques Roadshow was on, and I was looking as well at a sapphire, giant sapphire, the biggest sapphire that anyone's seen on Antiques Roadshow. It was worth 40 grand. And you could see the woman, she was selling that in an absolute heartbeat. In the She Believes Cup, England 2, USA 2. Go and watch Megan Rapinoe's volley that gave USA the lead. It was absolutely, it stayed hit. It was a full Yeboah. Steph Houghton equalised with a lovely curling effort and a decent move finished off by Nikita Paris to put England ahead. Phil Neville's getting some criticism for playing Lucy Bronze in midfield instead of at right back, but he's sticking with it. He says she's the best player in the world. The US equalised with a high-quality League Two scramble. And Japan beat Brazil 3-1 in the other game. So England and Japan top the She Believes Cup. And fun non-league Twitter accounts from Baldock Town FC. Parental advisory. 30 minutes. A bird has just shit on our goalkeeper coach's head. Oh, which is nice, isn't it? And finally, a question from Michael just came in. If you could throw a cheese slice on any Premier League manager's face, who would it be?
A cheese slice?
Or maybe like a Kraft cheese slice. So not a low-grade...
An easy single or something.
I guess so, yeah. I mean, you could unwrap a Dairy Lee triangle. You could take a laughing cow if you want. You can interpret the question however you like. It's just a fun way to finish the
podcast. Nuno Espirito Santo.
See if it gets stuck in his beard.
Yeah.
A whole brie in the beard of Nuno. Lars?
Neil Warnock, because I think he seems to be trying very hard to stay chipper. And you can all just see there's a lot of stuff bubbling under that smile when he does these interviews, having lost the match of the day. He's clearly working really hard to stay in composed. So I want to see, could you just, if a sort of bearded foreigner like me just throws some cheese at him to see if that'll break his thing.
What cheese would you pick? A whole Edam.
Bit of a sticky one, yeah. Okay. Just not an Edam.
No, okay.
As he's just back and he is the cheesiest manager, Brendan Rodgers.
Perfect. That'll do. Thanks for all your questions and all that stuff. Thanks, Baz.
You're welcome.
Thank you, Lars.
Thanks, Max.
Thank you, John.
Cheers, Max.
We'll be back on Thursday.
For more great podcasts from The Guardian, just go to theguardian.com/podcasts.